Hello there, Dan Dillman here, bringing you another little of this, a little of that. Thank you so much for tuning in to 101.5. We do enjoy having you here. In fact, we can't live without you. As we try to entertain you, inform you, and once in a while, maybe bring a smile to your face. Well, today's program is going to lead off with an item about the changing city. It's called the post-pandemic city. Downtowns are designed to serve a 9-to-5 workforce, and they are now mulling a makeover as workers embrace hybrid working models. From the Great Resignation to the Zoom revolution to the nationwide housing boom, the legacies of the pandemic are in many ways helping to redefine the meaning of urban life. The ability to work remotely has begun to change the geographies, if not the sensibilities, of millions of lives and careers, especially in America's major cities. 5 million people already have moved during the pandemic, according to economic surveys, and an estimated 14 million to 23 million more Americans are saying that they are likely to move as well as they become unmoored from their offices, especially those people in urban business districts. Today's COVID-precipitated crises may well prove to be the most transformative event that America has experienced since the Great Migration to the suburbs after World War II. In most American cities, fewer than half of office workers are returning to their desks each day, including those with hybrid schedules. Only 36% of office workers in the New York metro area were back at their desks at the start of this past April, which measures, according to CAST systems, and they are a company which measures key card swipes in buildings that it serves in 10 major cities. For cities, this is a problem. Empty offices bring a series of cascading effects. Storefronts shutter. Already cash-strapped transportation systems lose revenue, and tax spaces shrink, forcing public officials to cut services. In New York, subways and buses were carrying only 60% of their pre-pandemic riders at the start of April. Restaurant reservations remain 40% below pre-pandemic norms. And the city has lost up to a third of its small businesses for good, which helps to explain why its unemployment rate continues to hover around 7%, which is double the national average. With tough times and urban ennui come disorder. Indeed, crime has skyrocketed in New York and many cities across the country over the course of the two-year pandemic, thus compounding the challenge of luring people back into their offices in downtown of the cities. Still, even if the pandemic is disrupting lives and livelihoods, it is also spurring cities to search for ways to reinvent themselves, just as many did decades ago when factories closed or moved overseas. Perhaps we misthought central business districts as simply arenas for office work, with their sterile concentration of skyscrapers dearth of residences, and lack of activity at night, they are in many ways the last remaining holdover of the Industrial Revolution. Most cities have been designed around business districts and the office workers that commute in each day. Roads and public transportation systems have catered to these in and out flows. An economic ecosystem of shops and restaurants grew up to serve the commuters. Urban planners have thought about this for some years. Many now envision what they call a 15-minute city in which every resident would be within 15-minute walk or bike ride from anything they need, including parks and open spaces. Central business districts need to be reimagined as more of an essential lifestyle district or a central culture district. It would be designed to be something that is much more connected, much more diverse, and which would make it a lot more resilient. Indeed, as the work from home trend takes hold, not everyone is looking for a rural place or a suburban house with a yard. Millions still prefer an urban lifestyle, but in more livable cities. Urbanites want shorter commutes, access to more green space, as well as safe, affordable places to live. A number of cities are already sketching plans and making changes for a post-pandemic reality. And one common theme is that traditional office districts may no longer be as central to their downtown core. And with that, I'll step away for a moment or two, and I'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll play some music for you. I'm back again, and I have the question. What's behind the baby formula shortage? Thought I'd try to summarize some of the reasons for this shortage. Parents across the U.S. are scouring the internet. They're crossing state lines to get their hands on baby formula, as a national shortage has major retailers putting limits on the amount that customers can buy. The crisis has worsened over the past few weeks, with 40% of popular formula brands sold out at the end of April. More than half of the formula products were completely sold out in several states, including Texas. And images shared online showed empty formula aisles across the country. Some eBay listings for infant formula were priced almost double normal retail costs. Good old American way, gouge people in times of crisis. Well, specialty formulas for babies with allergies or with special medical needs were even more difficult to find. And there's no one reason for the shortage, showing that even the most essential items can fall through the cracks of strained global supply chains. Supply chain issues resulting from COVID-19 increased demand following the easing of pandemic restrictions. But the war in Ukraine and insufficient supplies of some commodities have all contributed. Panic buying has further reduced stocks, as is usually the case when something seems to be in short supply, whether it's baby formula or toilet paper, people hoard it. But the problem was made worse when Abbott Laboratories, which is the producer of top U.S. brand Similac, shut a major factory in Michigan and issued recalls in last February over contamination concerns. According to the Food and Drug Administration, four babies got sick, including two who died after being fed formula from that facility. And in March, the FDA published preliminary findings that Abbott had failed to maintain sanitary conditions. However, Abbott says a separate FDA investigation found no traces of bacteria linked to the illnesses in its formula. The company, however, is the main supplier for families on state benefits. Abbott says it's working with the FDA to reopen its Michigan plant while increasing shipments from its factory in Ireland, despite the fact that the second largest maker of baby formula, a company called Reckitt, had already shipped 30% more product than usual in the first 3 months of 2022. The shortage remains. And I think one thing that must be added to this is that there are only a small handful of companies that produce the baby formula. And we have, until now, prevented the import of baby formula from Europe. Seems like this is going to be a very complex issue to solve. I hope that you are not involved with it. It's not pleasant to find food for the kids. Well, we'll be back in a couple of minutes with another item we hope will inform you and interest you. The world is changing, and I'm referring to the world of travel. Every year, the New York Times has made a practice of listing the maybe the 30 most attractive cities and other places to travel in a given year. And these would be places where there were new hot restaurants, where you could easily get Airbnb reservations, and perhaps a new museum opening up for you to see. But the world of travel is changing since the pandemic, and the New York Times list this year of 30 places that you should visit has changed. The travel, remember, supports developed economies in places that depend on tourist dollars and exposes travelers to cultures and customs different from their own. But this new list of 30 places for a changed world now highlights places where change is happening, where endangered wildlands are being preserved, threatened species are being protected, historical wrongs are being acknowledged, fragile communities are being bolstered, and where travelers can be part of that change. So inspiration for more purposeful travel, more fulfilling travel, is the point of this segment of the program and for other programs during the summer. And we're going to tell you about some of these 30 places. And the first one today is Northumberland, England. Britain's diverse coastline from the cliffs of Dover to the boardwalks of Brighton will soon have a unifying element, and that is a 2,800-mile England Coast Path. This has been developed in part by the governmental organization Natural England. The path aims to increase public access to the coast while also restoring landscapes, improving community connection, and promoting sustainable travel. Travel segments that have opened include a 44-mile stretch in the northeast from the River Tyne and to the Northumberland coast, which is the epitome of rugged England, with its misty dunes, rocky headlands, and wild beaches. At night, be sure to look up if you're there, because the Northumberland International Dark Sky Park has some of the lowest light pollution in the country and features one of the largest areas of protected night sky in Europe. Gaze at the galaxies sprayed across the sky, and then venture to the ancient past as Hadrian's Wall celebrates its 1900th anniversary with a year-long festival. And then another place that I should mention is Normandy, France. Environmentally friendly, it has developed bike trails that could inspire impressionist painters. Remember Claude Monet's paintings of Normandy's moody Atlantic coast? Well, they can now have another element, a bicycle path. New bicycle routes in the region include a 900-mile Velo Martin, which starts south in Brittany, travels along the shore of the English Channel, and ends at the Belgian border. Along the way, Mont Saint-Michel rises out of the water, and World War II's D-Day landing beaches beckon. The Velo Maritime is one of the newer trails making up the Euro Velo, a bike network that aims to unite the European continent. And the new 260-mile La Sena Velo, with a focus on environmental friendly bicycle tourism and connecting with local communities, begins at Notre Dame in Paris and follows the Seine to the Normandy coast through sun-dappled countryside. La Sena Avelo's final stretch swoops through the area, eventually taking you to the cradle of Camembert, Calvados, and cider. Hope you make your plans for these areas. I have a mystery, and I think I have maybe a solution or a partial solution to it. And this is from a new book. It's entitled How to Build Stonehenge by Mike Pitts. And the publisher is Thames and Hudson. Archaeologist Mike Pitts takes an engineering and a scientific approach to the monument of Stonehenge. On Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, England, there rests an extraordinary monument that has puzzled and inspired people for millennia, the circular set of rocks known as Stonehenge. The iconic scene, so precisely designed and constructed, provokes a litany of questions. What motivated the Neolithic people to create such a thing? Where did the huge 20-ton stones come from? How was it built? While he doesn't try to answer the first of these questions of why, writing that imagination is the only limit to finding a motive, he does break down the second question into several components: how the stones were obtained, how they were moved to the site, how the structure was erected, and how its construction has changed over time. Overall, the book feels geared toward readers who relish granular technicalities of geological analysis. Yet for those who are more interested in the human aspects of Stonehenge's construction, Mike Fitz's review of how megaliths have been handled over time still proves noteworthy and worthy of your time. Over the past century, people in Madagascar, India, Myanmar, and Indonesia have raised rock monuments with stones similar in size to those of Stonehenge. Archaeologist Ron Adams spent several years in the early 2000s on the Indonesian island of Sumba. There, he watched hundreds of men transport one rock slab at a time as part of a wealthy man's future burial site. That process sheds light on how the builders of Stonehenge might have transported their heavy stones. Now, in Indonesia, a core group of about 40 laborers typically stayed with the rock slab over the entire route, working shoulder to shoulder for a month or two as they pulled their cargo by rope across wooden trackways. Often, there would be additional hands at the start of the trek, when a community leader or priest would give a ceremonial blessing. Then, as the trip progressed, the laborers would be visited or joined by the locals, a slew of caregivers who would feed the workers, house them, and perhaps replace those who could not afford to spend any more time away from their families. And so, granted, the ancient builders of Stonehenge may have experienced a wholly different social dynamic than in Indonesia, but at least this image from the tropics begins to provide a very educated guess of what it could be like. Now, if this is something of interest to you, you might want to see if your local library has the book, or even order it. As I said, it's entitled How to Build Stonehenge by Mike Fitz, by Thames and Hudson, and it was just recently published. That will give you some more information than I have time for today. And so, as we near the end of the show, I have just a few comments to make that I might call, did you know? British oil giant BP said this week that the divestment in its 19% stake in Russia's state-controlled oil company has cost it $25 billion. And this accounted for nearly half of BP's oil and gas reserves and one-third of its production. And then the Ukraine's digital minister said about 150,000 people in the country are using SpaceX Starlink satellite service in order to connect to the internet, using more than 10,000 Starlink terminals. And finally, 95% of the 100 biggest U.S. housing markets are less affordable than their long-term levels. That figure was at 6% at the start of the pandemic. 37 markets are less affordable than they have ever been. And maybe time for an additional comment. GM said it expects future car buyers to pay an average of $135 a month, in addition to their monthly car payment, for bonus features such as navigation and hands-free driving technology. The company hopes for $20 billion to $25 billion a year in new software and subscription revenue. And with that, I want to say that I want you to please tune in next time to 101.5 to a little of this, a little of that. We're here to inform, to entertain, and once in a while, maybe to amuse you. You be healthy, stay safe, be kind to each other, and we'll get along a lot better. Try understanding problems of your friends and those around you, and they'll do the same for you. With that, Willie Nelson, you're going to join me as he usually does every day, every program. And we're going to go down the road looking for additional features which would be appropriate for a little of this, a little of that. Remember, you're apt to hear information about almost anything here. So don't go away. Be a regular member of the 101.5 Club by staying with us each week. Willie, it's time for us to go down the road again. Let's go home.